Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the irrational and unwarranted panic generated by prominent ignoramuses like Donald Trump that treating Americans infected with Ebola on American soil, as opposed to letting them die in Africa, somehow exposes the American people to unnecessary risk. A leading expert on rare and deadly viruses like MERS, SARS, Marburg, and Ebola, Dr. Ian Lipkin, the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University, joins us to discuss how these lethal viruses spread and what is done to contain them, as well as addressing the spread of unscientific and anti-intellectual medical disinformation in the country at large that has led to the reemergence of all but eradicated diseases as a result of parents not immunizing their children based on bogus and discredited theories. Then we'll get an assessment of the security situation in Afghanistan following the killing of an American general and the wounding of a German general and 14 others by a soldier in the Afghanistan army at Afghanistan's equivalent of West Point. Marvin Weinbaum, who served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan at the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, joins us to discuss the impending withdrawal of U.S. and NATO forces at a time when the results of the recent election to succeed the corrupt and erratic Hamid Karzai is in dispute, with no clear way to settle the country's latest rigged presidential election. Then finally, we will examine the Africa summit underway in Washington with Sasha Lezhnev, Associate Director and Senior Policy Analyst at the Enough Project. He is the author of Crafting Peace, Strategies to Deal with Warlords in Collapsing States, and has an article at the Daily Beast co-authored with John Prendergast, Obama's Africa Summit and the New Danger in Congo. We'll discuss what it will take to end the most deadly war since World War II in eastern Congo and the need for many corrupt and entrenched African leaders to give up power and accept opposition politics and allow free elections. And joining us now is Dr. Ian Lipkin, who's the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. He has over 30 years' experience in microbiology and outbreak responses, and in 1980s, Dr. Lipkin identified AIDS-associated immunological abnormalities and was the first to use purely molecular methods to identify infectious agents and implicated West Nile virus as the cause of the encephalitis epidemic in New York in 1999. He has assisted the World Health Organization and the People's Republic of China during the 2003 SARS outbreak, and his team have discovered or characterized more than 500 infectious agents. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Ian Lipkin.
Good to be back with you, Ian.
And I'm astounded by a lot of the ignorance that's pervading the press in terms of feeding into these paranoid delusions, which are more suitable in Hollywood movies than they are in the real world, that somehow because a couple of doctors and a medical worker or a missionary had been infected with Ebola in Africa, that the fact that they've been brought here to the United States somehow is putting the entire population of the United States in danger? I mean, where is the pushback coming here?
It is disturbing. It's quite sad. You know, it is a humanitarian crisis in West Africa. And I think that's really the way we need to think about it. There is the risk that someone could come back and perhaps infect a handful of people, which would be tragic indeed. But the conditions that were, you know, that pertain in West Africa don't pertain here. So we're not anticipating anything like what would occur with a respiratory tract infection. And, you know, some of the things that we are hearing, they're awful. You know, these people should, you know, are getting their just desserts and such. I think that's terrible. It's shocking.
So why then do you think the press is featuring people like Donald Trump's ignorant responses? And even our national security advisor, Susan Rice, said, there's a very small chance of it happen, anybody getting infected. This, I think, requires a more robust and intelligent and scientific response, doesn't it?
I agree with you. We do what we can. I mean, I've been spending more time on television than I care to. Not only doing the shows where we're preaching to the converted, which would be, you know, CNN and such, but, you know, some of the other smaller networks that are more, I have been raising some of these issues. And every time I've had an opportunity to speak on these other networks and spoken to anchors, we've been able to make the point, I think, quite clearly. And there's been reception, good reception, to the notion that this just doesn't make any sense. So I think there's some conspiracy theorists who are pushing these concepts that this is, you know, the coming plague. But I don't think it's really gone mainstream. I certainly hope it hasn't. It hasn't on the East Coast. I don't know what's happening. Yeah, in L.A.
Out here in La La Land, you mean?
Right.
Well, let's talk then about the science and in terms of how this is obviously a deadly virus, Ebola, and we last spoke with when you were in Saudi Arabia dealing with MERS, another dangerous. Is that a hemorrhagic disease as well?
No, that's really neither is SARS. They do is they. You know, the difference is that, you know, with the respiratory pathogens, which is what MERS and SARS and some of the higher pathogenic influenzas are, you know, they cause respiratory disease. Now, MERS also causes renal failure, kidney failure. Mm-hmm. But Ebola and related virus, Marburg, are different. What they do is they actually cause a wide systemic infection. They turn on a whole series of genes which release proteins which cause inflammation, and you wind up losing fluids, going into shock, and going into multi-system failure. Some people believe that that's the more dramatic version that was featured in the movie Outbreak. That's really not very common. Maybe less than half of patients have that particular manifestation. But it's a dismal disease. Minimum 60% mortality in some outbreaks, as high as 90%. So it is a concern, and we are losing a lot of people in West Africa as a result.
But I take it, though, that respiratory transmitted diseases like MERS and SARS are more dangerous because you're talking about just breathing the air, right, as opposed to touching people's bodies and transferring, you know, bodily fluids, which I believe is the path with Ebola.
Right. There's a classic concept that we use in epidemiology referred to as the R-naught, which describes the reproductive rate of the infectious agent. So an R-naught of 2 means that one person who's infected will infect 2 more people on average. And obviously, the higher that R-naught, the more people become infected. Some agents have R-naughts as high as 6 or 8. The R-naught for this one is somewhat difficult to explain because here we're talking about an R-naught that can be reduced to virtually zero if you simply don't touch the secretions, right? So the usual sorts of concepts that we worry about with respiratory or diarrheal agents simply don't apply here. So this is a lethal disease, but it is possible to interfere with transmission beyond the original group if you contain people and simply handle the discarded material in a safe way. And that's what's being done in Atlanta. So the notion that the homeland is unsafe because people have been moved to this isolation unit in Emory, just, you know, it doesn't make any sense.
So are we in a situation now, which I recall back in the 1980s, there was a young fellow called Ryan White who was diagnosed with AIDS. He was 13 years old. He'd got HIV from a blood transfusion, and he was kicked out of his school. He had to sue to get back into his school, etc. At the time, that seemed to be an awful, almost, you know, going back to the days of witch hunts in the early period of America's history. So have we evolved, do you think, as a society since the days of the hysteria over young Ryan White?
Well, so I think that's an instructive comparison. In that instance, people were concerned that because this is a persistent infection, there's potential if Ryan White were to have become a blood donor or to had, you know, sexual relations with somebody, that he might have transmitted this particular virus. So in those days, as you remember, we didn't have any therapy whatsoever. In this case, the individuals who were being treated in Atlanta at Emory are ultimately going to receive a clean bill of health. That is assuming, you know, they don't have an untimely demise, which I don't anticipate because they both seem to be responding well to supportive care and to plasma therapy. So there is a tendency, even after symptoms resolve, for Ebola virus nucleic acid, the genetic markers for the virus, to persist in some bodily fluids, but we can test those until they're clear. And once they're clear, it's over. In fact, you could say that they're the safest ones of all at that point because they have antibodies. They protect them in the event that they were ever to encounter Ebola again. So it is an instructive comparison, but I am concerned in the short term that these people are being treated like pariahs. And as I say, the email traffic that I've received is 50%, you know, thank you for, you know, putting the fear-mongering to rest. And the other half, which comes and tells me that I'm misleading the American public and opening and abetting, you know, an incursion of the homeland with a dread disease. And it's very disturbing to receive this sort of thing. I imagine their families are receiving those same sorts of notes.
And Dr. Limkin, what do you know about the treatment that was given to both of them? And apparently they responded both to Nancy Reitball and Dr. Kent Brantley. I believe they've responded to them already.
Well, you know, the challenge in interpreting the response is, number one, we don't really have detailed information about what actually happened. It's not well documented. And secondly, this is not a disease with 100% mortality or even 90% mortality. In this outbreak, it's more like 60%. So we don't know to what extent this is natural course versus response to the antibodies. Although the antibodies are plausible, and it's something that, you know, we and others have proposed should be undertaken in the event that we had such an outbreak. And the, you know, one of the individuals received passive immunotherapy as a result of receiving a plasma infusion from an individual who'd recovered from Ebola, which would contain high concentrations of antibodies that bind to the virus, prevent it from entering other cells and replicating. The latest modification is that there's a synthetic antibody about which there aren't many details yet. I understand, and this is just what I've been able to put together from incomplete accounts, that is produced in tobacco plants, which would be wonderful, isn't it? Sort of the merchants of death are finally doing something worthwhile, producing recombinant proteins that have therapeutic efficacy. And those would be a cocktail of antibodies that each binds to different portions of the virus and multiplies the effect that you would have with a single type. So this is very good. You know, the whole concept of plasma therapy, which we're coming back to now, is one of the first medical interventions that was successful, the first Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine, which was given to von Behring for discovering the diphtheria antitoxin. That, in fact, was an antibody, right? It was the same sort of an approach. So it's interesting that we're sort of rediscovering the wheel over 100 years later.
But we also, though, as a society, have apparently accepted this anti-science panic over immunizing your children. I mean, you know, here in California, parents have the option of not having their kids immunized, even though it used to be required that your kids couldn't go to school unless they were immunized. And now we have rubella coming back here in California and other diseases that had long almost been extinguished because the herd is immunized, but now you have all these outliers, and it's tolerated. That's the part of it that I don't understand.
Well, these are very complicated issues. It is true that there are occasional vaccine-related incidents, but they're vanishingly rare, and they're certainly far outweighed by the risks of getting wild-type rubella, rubeola, or diphtheria. And and as you've said, if we don't all take the vaccine, then the herd immunity, which protects those people who we know can't receive vaccine, such as people who are immunosuppressed, you know, that's lost. So absent a clear indication for somebody being intolerant to vaccine, it really is important for us as a community to all pull together and ensure the safety of our children. I agree with you. It's terrible. We've tried to make this argument with respect to MMR and autism going back now, it's almost 15 years since we did that first work. And I'm shocked to see that people still are concerned about the measles vaccine as being a risk factor for autism. It just doesn't make sense. There's no data to support it. And you know, what you're right in thinking, saying that You know, the people who are most likely to avoid these vaccines tend to be people who are, you know, fairly well educated and economically well off. You know, sometimes I don't know how to reach people other than to try to talk about the science as best we can. But it is disheartening.
So in terms of the politics, I guess the one good thing we can say about the hysteria surrounding these patients in Atlanta with Ebola, the idea that somehow that this is going to infect the rest of us, which is out there in the media. But the one good thing I guess we can say is that the Congress is recessed. We don't have Congress people standing up and saying the kind of idiocy that Donald Trump is tweeting. I bring that up because my understanding is that yesterday public health funds were cut, that the Congress had cut public health funds and they went into effect yesterday.
Look, that's as, you know, there are a few challenges to us, I think, politically, humanistically, economically, as daunting as the efforts to defund science and humanities and arts. It truly is frightening, and the implications for us as a culture and a society. The actual budget, if you look at inflation over the past, you know, say since 2008, we've gone down between 20% and 25% in earning power. We are losing an entire generation of young scientists who might otherwise have gone into science. We're funding grants, maybe 5% or 10% of what goes into a single review panel, as opposed to, you know, the 20 to 25% that should receive support. And we are falling behind while other countries are promoting increases in their budgets by 5 or 10% per year. And I don't mean to say that they should cut back on that at all. I applaud them for funding science and funding research and engineering and everything else that will make for a better life for us all. But the United States is going to fall behind, and this is something that is of great concern to the scientific community and to the business community, and it should. So the Congress needs to realize and wake up to the fact that we must do more, and we can to some extent do more with less. But after you cut away all the fat and start moving through the meat, you eventually get to the bone, and that's where we are right now. We're losing scientists. We have a reverse brain drain. You know, in terms of what we used to see, we used to draw brilliant scientists from all over the world who wanted to come here and work in the United States. And those numbers are dropping. They're going elsewhere. They're returning to China. They're going to Europe. And they're very important. I mean, people have tried to analyze the results of the investment in the Genome Project, for example. It has more than repaid the investment. The last I heard, it was somewhere between 10 and 100 fold. And this is something that, you know, that story is not yet fully written, but we desperately need to reinvest in science and engineering and arts and humanities and these things that make America what it is.
So just in closing, Dr. Ian Lipkin, just to try and ameliorate the panic here, because I just before I talked to you, I was talking to somebody in Washington, and she said, oh, I'm really scared about Ebola. And I thought, my God, you know, this is an intelligent woman that runs a big organization. So my understanding, for example, I did some work a while back on biological warfare with the deputy director of the secret Soviet program that went on for decades after the U.S. and Russia had signed an agreement during the Nixon administration to banish biological weapons.
And Vector.
Yeah.
Well, let me just clarify one thing there, because I think it's important to give this man his due, although I'm not a great fan of Richard Nixon.
Right.
The decision to abandon offensive biologicals was a unilateral decision on the part of Richard Nixon. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. People don't realize and give him credit for that.
Right.
The guy doesn't deserve credit for much. But it's remarkable that this was his sort of Quaker upbringing in Whittier coming to the fore at some point. You're right. I mean, they manufactured all sorts of things. But
none of it got out. That was the point I wanted to make, is that they do have procedures. I mean, this stuff would have killed us all if the variola got out, but there are procedures in place, not that I'm in any way justifying offensive biological weapons.
Well, they had an anthrax.
That's true.
Which infected local people and did a lot of damage to animals in the area. But you're right. I mean, The variola did not. It was never used. It's hard to imagine that they would have ever used variola. Ironically, the Russians were absolutely key in helping with the vaccines that were used to eradicate smallpox, variola. So it would have, somehow I think that that's something that they would never have done. But we don't know where half of these, we don't know the half of it. I mean, there's so much that happened in Vector, in Novosibirsk. But at this point, it's a first-class research institution, and they're doing a lot of work on emerging infectious diseases from the vantage point of diagnostics, understanding how they become pathogenic, and finding ways to treat and prevent disease.
Well, Dr. Ian Lipkin, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Ian Lipkin, who's the director of the Center for Infection and Immunity at Columbia University. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the killing of an American general by a soldier in the Afghanistan National Army at Afghanistan's equivalent of West Point.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all. دو چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنی نازداری با موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی بچند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Marvin Weinbaum, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois and a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. From 1999 to 2003, he served as an analyst on Pakistan and Afghanistan for the United States Department of State's Bureau of Intelligence and Research, and he is the author of The Future of Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Marvin Weinbaum.
Yes. Hello, Ian.
Hello, Marvin, and Afghan soldier just shot a U.S. Army major general, wounded a German brigadier general, and at least 14 other U.S. and Afghan military service members. And this happened at the equivalent of Afghanistan's West Point. This is, of course, the highest-ranking American soldier to have died since the Vietnam War, Major General Harold J. Green, who's apparently a veteran acquisitions officer. We've seen a lot of this blue-on-green violence, as it's called. It seems to have abated a little bit, but this is a real uptick, certainly in terms of the prominence of the victims here.
Well, Ian, as you point out, we haven't seen it really in recent months. We sourced a number of incidents early in the year and last year, but there have been precautions taken. And it seems in this case, of course, that nothing was good enough. But we have felt a little bit maybe overconfident that we had this one licked.
But isn't this always when this happens? It makes one question whether or not, perhaps below the surface, amongst a lot of Afghans, there's a sort of seething kind of bitterness that isn't necessarily detected by screening processes. Is this a problem that there's just such a cultural divide here that really there's not much that can bridge it?
Well, you may be looking at it in too large a way here. Obviously, there are individuals who, for whatever reason, bear grudges. They may be indeed ideological, and they have they're seething, as you say, with the notion that these are the occupiers and they should be gotten rid of. But to say that necessarily this reflects the view in the Afghan military might be carrying it a bit far. Certainly, this is an extraordinary event. All it needs is one person who feels this way. So I'd caution here about reading it in too large a way.
So then what do you make then, Marvin Weinbaum, of the fact that the Taliban said that they're normally quick to take credit for these kind of attacks, but in this case they didn't?
Well, that does suggest that he may have been acting on individual motives, on personal motives, so that that would tend to reinforce that. I understand, though, that they applauded his action. The fact that he took out a general may have suggested that, certainly he was waiting for, one would imagine, the NATO generals and officials to come, because they're not regularly there, certainly not at that level of rank. So this might have been, on his part, quite well planned. It's hard to separate out. The Taliban itself is in many ways, not a very tightly knit organization. So there may be some elements who are disowning or at least not claiming responsibility, but that doesn't mean, though, that this wasn't inspired by a group of Taliban.
So in terms of the overall picture, though, where you have this election that's being disputed now, and the Secretary of State Kerry had to go over and try and mediate between the two candidates, one of whom is favored by Karzai and the other one who's still bitter about the fact that he felt that he won the previous election that was fraught with fraud. And
he also did considerably better in the first round and had every reason to believe that he was within a stone's throw of having the presidency.
Exactly. So in the case of this current round, what's your sense of how this dispute's going to be settled?
Well, this is very disconcerting for us, because we were hoping on a smooth political transition, which would then pave the way for the signing of the BSA, the Bilateral Security Agreement, and the clearing the way for the U.S. and NATO as well to keep a reasonably small contingent of trainers and special forces there, at least through 2016. But without a legitimate government in the next few months, what I think one really has to worry about is that even if they reach an agreement ultimately, there is damage being done. It's naturally eroding the confidence of a lot of people. The great fear is that if there isn't a government in place, that the military itself will start to come apart. And that would spell, certainly, the beginning of what most observers believe is a civil war. So what gives me some confidence that this is not going to happen is that the two men are really, in political terms, in policy terms, are really very much alike. Also, they and so many others, however bitter their feelings towards one another, have in mind the nightmare of going into a civil war such as they had in the 1990s, which, destroyed much of Kabul. That for them, if that's standing out there as the possible outcome, I just feel in the end that somehow this is going to be resolved.
But it seems to me, in terms of this political deadlock over Karzai's successor, that Karzai is the winner here. First of all, he still doesn't want to sign the security deal. And as long as this situation is in flux, I take it that his influence is prolonged.
It is certainly so, although now there are strong accusations that he was involved in some of the fraudulent activities during the second round. So I think that up until now, the feeling was, well, he's going to relinquish his presidency. He seemed to play it pretty straight during the election process. But now there are serious doubts that are arising as to whether he, in fact, didn't intervene in a much greater way than we've known. A recent revelation of a phone call of his vice president seemed to suggest a deeper involvement on the part of the palace here in this in this rigging. It certainly it took place. Whether it took place on both sides is another matter. It probably did, but the only way in which we can resolve this is to go through this laborious process here of effectively recounting or re-examining all of the ballots, and that's the process we're in. There's been a lot of difficulty trying to get the two sides to agree on what standards they would use to throw out ballots. But in the election that took place in 2009, 1.2 million ballots that had been cast for Hamid Karzai were thrown out. Now, if that were the case, something like that now, then Abdullah would be the next president. So that's why they're both hanging in, because both have good reason to believe that they can come out on top.
So, Marvin Weinbaum, there have been some recent criticism of President Obama's handling of foreign policy, that he is sort of aloof and not engaged, and he addressed it last Friday in a press conference. But there's no secret that the president has a difficult time, for example, with Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel.
And Hamid Karzai
and al-Maliki in Iraq. Yeah. And the fact that he sort of can't stand these people, it seems to me in foreign policy that you don't have the luxury of having opinions about people you have to deal with. You just have to deal with them.
Well, this is where Secretary Kerry becomes so important here, because he has been able to maintain better relations with those individuals. However, I think you have to view these as situations where there are really very few good choices, and where we don't have the leverage that we would like to have, and that perhaps many in our own country think that we do have. So the president's, effectively saying each one of these cases has to be viewed on its own merits, and that we can't get everything we want. And that seems to be the case here. So, yes, I would fault the president, for example, on setting firm dates for the U.S. withdrawal. I think this was a mistake. But otherwise, I don't see any great faults here in his policy. Let's put it this way, the American public, whether it's Iraq or Afghanistan, really has grown tired of both of these wars, and however they may criticize the president, at the same time, they don't want U.S. involvement there or in Syria as well. So, that's the reality. We want to have it both ways, that we don't want to make a commitment, and yet we want to be able to do more.
But when you say, Marvin Weinbaum, that the U.S. doesn't have any leverage, that strikes me, and I'm sure it strikes a lot of our listeners, as rather painful in the sense that the United States has lost 2,198 members of its military in Afghanistan, and 19,899 U.S. service members have been wounded in Afghanistan. And we have spent, I don't know what the figures are, probably close to $1 trillion. And so after all of that sacrifice and all of that treasure, we have no leverage?
Well, maybe I said that a little too strongly. We don't have certainly the leverage that would enable us to influence outcomes the way we would like. Obviously, we do have leverage. And what has gotten the two aspirants for the presidency to at least agree to turn to, for example, the United Nations here for a way out to resolve their differences has been because Secretary Kerry said, and in fact the president said very clearly, that if they couldn't get together, they couldn't expect any kind of aid, and now we're talking about economic aid going forward. That certainly got their attention. So I overstated by saying we have no leverage, but we certainly don't have the kind of leverage that would have gotten Hamid Karzai, for example, to sign the BSA, something which he had all of the support that he needed within the domestic realm to be able to do. And yet he's an ornery guy, and we could not turn him. In the end, I think that we can use our leverage, what we have, But we have to be careful that we use it in a smart way, because these people also, if anything else, have pride. They don't want to be pushed around either. So it's delicate diplomacy.
So in terms of Pakistan's role, which have always been key, in effect, that many argue that every U.S. service member and every NATO service member that died, in many ways, Pakistan has their blood on its hands because of the duplicity in both being, you know, in effect, a U.S. ally, at least a recipient of a tremendous amount of U.S. aid, being the recipient of all of the money that goes along with the land routes of all the material going in to Afghanistan via Pakistan, at the same time surreptitiously organizing, funding, and perhaps even training the Taliban, but at the very least giving them sanctuary inside Pakistan. My understanding is that of late Pakistan is going through a kind of rethinking of its role in this whole era, and may be now sort of having some kind of buyer's remorse, or at least concern, that an unstable Afghanistan run by the Taliban, or at least dominated by the Taliban, could in fact backfire on them in terms of their own problem with Pakistan's Taliban, and that in effect you could have a reverse sanctuary situation where Pakistan's Taliban could attack the Pakistan government and its military and then retreat into Afghanistan.
Yes, we already see that. And I think you're absolutely correct. Pakistan, if we go back to the 1990s, had every reason to want to see an Afghanistan which was weak, coming apart, and which would be docile, really, be certainly obliged to Pakistan and under the thumb of Pakistan. But that's changed, because as against what the situation was in the 90s, now Pakistan has its own insurgency. And so it's got to see that insurgency through the lens, or see Afghanistan through the lens of that insurgency. And as you point out, now a success by the Taliban would be dangerous for Pakistan, because it would energize Pakistan's own extremists. And let me put it this way, that if Afghanistan goes the way of civil war, if it goes into chaos, we may have the greatest worries, not in Afghanistan, but its influence on Pakistan, a country with a large nuclear arsenal, a country which, after all, together with Afghanistan, has been the launching pad for international terrorists. And we worry also about the effect on Indian-Pakistan relations and the possibility of a shooting war between those two countries. So we have the greatest stake in Pakistan. But Pakistan may very well, what happens in Pakistan may very well be contingent upon what happens in Afghanistan.
Well, Marvin Weinbaum, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Surely.
Again, I've been speaking with Marvin Weinbaum, who's a professor emeritus of political science at the University of Illinois and a scholar in residence at the Middle East Institute. We're going to take a brief station break and back, getting an update on the Africa Summit underway in Washington.
دل شکاری رنگ گل اناری لطف نصیب ما کو رنگی نظاری زاری ہے رنگی نظاری زاری
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Sasha Sasha Lezhnev, who is the Associate Director and Senior Policy Analyst at the Enough Project, where he focuses on peace and conflict minerals in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's the author of the book Crafting Peace, Strategies to Deal with Warlords in Collapsing States, and he has an op-ed at the Daily Beast with John Prendergast, Obama's Africa Summit and the New Danger in Congo. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sasha Lezhnev.
Great. Thanks for having me, Ian.
And I obviously want to talk to you about the new dangers in the Congo and the work that you've been doing in that regard. But just to touch on the three-day summit underway in Washington, the first ever Africa summit here in the United States, today it seems to have been devoted to business deals. And the Obama administration said on Tuesday that U.S. businesses have struck more than $14 billion in deals with Africa. And President Obama announced $33 billion in commitments on Tuesday. I take it that in many ways the U.S. is playing catch up to China. Do you think that's a subtext here?
I think it is. I think that China has been much more strategic in its engagement, kind of head-on engagement in Africa, and has seen several years ago that it's kind of running out of natural resources, and so it said, all right, well, Africa's a new frontier. The colonial power has left. The U.S. is peddling along with NGO projects and small-time aid. So why don't we get a hold of some of these natural resources? And so the U.S. is, I think, finally realizing that there are some new frontier opportunities out there. You've seen, according to the latest figures, $17 billion in new deals, particularly regarding infrastructure, which is quite interesting. You've seen Ford, Lockheed Martin, Chevron, Marriott, Citigroup, and others who were starting to get engaged in Africa. And some of those are new companies that haven't been there in the past. You know, Walmart's also present through a subsidiary in South Africa. So I think this is a sign that over the years to come, we may see some increased competition economically.
So tell me then, the previous day was devoted to civic questions about civic society, and it seems to me that while it's American corporations are seeing a new frontier and trying to play catch up to Chinese, I don't know how modern day international businesses compare to 19th century colonialism, but there are certain echoes of that. But tell me about what is being done in terms of civic society. Because back in 2009, after President Obama was elected, he did give a speech in Accra, Ghana, stressing the need to get rid of dictators and strongmen and to build civic society. How much was that dealt with in yesterday's forum?
I think this has been a real mixed bag when it comes to administration on Africa. I think in some cases we've seen really positive engagement. So the U.S.'s engagement with Senegal and their transition, with Nigeria and their transition, but we're still seeing, some bright-eyed support for, frankly, some dictatorial regimes like Equatorial Guinea, where there was some new agreements that are being signed, turning somewhat of a blind eye to other countries that have numerous governance problems, like Rwanda, for example. Certainly there's been a lot of bark, but not much bite on election issues in the Democratic Republic of Congo. So, the U.S. finally took some measures to curtail aid to Uganda earlier this year, but that was mostly in response to their anti-homosexuality bill, not with regard to President Museveni's nearly 30 years in power. The track record on democratization and supporting democratic change in Africa is pretty mixed so far. I think that the administration really should work more closely with civil society. And I think one area that's they seem to have an interest in, which is positive, is regard to natural resources. So they spend some considerable amount of time talking about natural resource governance. The U.S. Committed to implement the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. They're supportive of initiatives to gain disclosure of corporate entities, which is pretty revolutionary, frankly. They don't seem to be quite as far ahead as the Europeans, for example, on that issue, but they are certainly much further ahead than previous administrations. So I think, you know, what we really want to see is more pressure on some of these leaders who have overstayed their power. The Burundian president, Nkurunziza, Kagame in Rwanda, Kabila in Congo. You know, we need to see peaceful transitions that are successful in Africa and not simply coups d'etat that can unravel these countries.
Well, isn't there a bit of a problem there when you have up almost 50 African heads of state here in Washington at President Obama's invitation, and many of them have been in power for decades? So on the one hand, you're hosting them, and on the other hand, you know, who's signaling to them that it's time to retire?
Yeah, that's right. I think that there needs to be more efforts to really work towards the retirement, you know, and come up with innovative initiatives like Mo Ibrahim's initiative, who gives awards to countries who make those, or to leaders actually, that make the transition process successful from one head of state to the next. That award that he gives out is oftentimes not actually taken up at all. So it'd be helpful if the administration launched more initiatives on that. The area that we focus on in particular, where I work at the Enough Project, is in conflict areas. And here I think we have also seen a mixed bag when it comes to the administration's policy. On the one hand, we have former Wisconsin Senator Russ Feingold, as appointed to be the special envoy to the Democratic Republic of Congo in the Great Lakes region, and he's done a really fantastic job in his work as the highest ever level senior envoy to Congo. And on the other hand, you have you know, really mixed policies with regard to Sudan and South Sudan, where, you know, we need new policies to both eliminate corruption, stop conflict gold trade, and support transitions and peaceful resolution of conflict, and not nearly as high level as engagement as we have seen on Congo.
Let's talk about the new danger in Congo. In your article at the Daily Beast, Sasha, you point out that the war that's been going on in Congo now has left more people dead than any war since World War II. Many people have suggested over the years that somehow we have something of a double standard. We intervene in, for example, in the former Yugoslavia when Europeans are killing each other, but somehow or another we've let this massacre go on for decades with rather feckless intervention by the United Nations.
That's right. You know, most people have heard of the Rwandan genocide. People know what happened in Yugoslavia or Iraq or Somalia. But in fact, every American is connected to Congo via their cell phones, their iPhones, and their computers. There's the small minerals in each product that make those devices work. So tin, tantalum, and tungsten, as well as gold, are the conflict minerals that have been fueling the war in Congo. And Americans have slowly become more aware of the conflict that has been fueled by those minerals, because there's legislation that has been passed and some leading efforts by Intel and Apple and Motorola Solutions to combat the problem. But still, there are armed groups that are fighting in eastern Congo, partially over the minerals, in particular gold, at the moment, but partially for other reasons as well. And one of the main issues that's occurring right now is that there is an African dispute over what to do with one of the central rebel groups that is left over, one that helped lead the Rwandan genocide, in fact, called the FDLR. And just last month, while most Americans were celebrating the 4th of July, Congo and several of its neighbors had a dispute about what to do about the FDLR. And this is an area that this is a rebel group that the United Nations agreed to help fight earlier this year. And again, it was a situation of all bark and no bite, where everyone talked up an initiative to fight the rebels, and there was no operations that actually ensued. And so right now during the summit, there will be a big meeting in New York about this with senior officials from the United States, Samantha Power, Russ Feingold, and others, with leaders of the region. And this is a real opportunity to reverse this dispute and move forward. Because frankly, if the FDLR is allowed to regroup, which it looks like it is doing at the moment, we could see a lot more bloodshed by virtue of the fact that Rwanda could feel a major security threat and again sponsor armed rebellion in Congo.
So is there a problem, though, Sasha Lezhnev, in terms of Europeans trying to urge African leaders to deal with genocide in this case, which is about as serious an issue as you could possibly have, but corruption and others? I mean, for example, one of the people that's excluded from this summit in Washington is the Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, who's been, again, I talk about term limits, he's been in there forever. Jacob Zuma has influence over him, but has never really wanted to use it at the urging of the United States and other European powers. So what kind of chances are they of this meeting taking place that you just mentioned, having influence over Kabila and Jacob Zuma in terms of ponying up? Because South Africa clearly has the means, at least in military terms, of having an effective force as opposed to the UN force, which it was less than useful.
Well, Congo is a sovereign country, and so it really is up to them to lead on the problem. The U.S. is currently working to pressure the Congolese to really start these military operations. But I think that the U.S. needs to work with South Africa as a partner to help influence Congo, that this cannot just simply be a highly corrupt dictator and President Kabila dictating to the African powers in South Africa and the world powers more broadly to on his sort of personal agenda. That just doesn't make sense. So, the U.S. needs to work with South Africa, with Tanzania, countries that are relatively close to the United States and on multiple agendas, to get Congo to take action. And South Africa has demonstrated some strong commitments. They have a number of troops on the ground. There are about 3,000 troops from South Africa, Tanzania, and Malawi on the ground in Congo. And so it's really time for them to be part of a solution to this, pretty strong regional security threat. This is a threat left over from the genocide that will continue to fester, as sort of a moral eyesore, not just on Congo, but on all of our consciences, because this is a United Nations operation. These are conflict minerals that go into our electronics. This is something that affects us all. So I think we really need to be part of the solution. And the key is to really, impress this upon the Congolese government, which can't simply dictate to everyone.
But is there something that can be done in terms of when you say Kabila is corrupt, which is certainly the case, And presumably what's happening here with these conflict minerals is that the people who broker them and the people who import them and use them in the West probably pay off people like Kabila as opposed to sanction him and make him behave better. Is that the problem?
I think the main problem at the moment is more of a more localized dispute between Congo and Rwanda. And we always knew that particular relationship has been at the center of the war. Now, the key is to come up with a diplomatic solution, both involving the United Nations, the U.S., and some of the regional countries, Angola, South Africa, to help bring those countries together. And Angola is currently chair of the regional organization that of the Central African countries. And so they have been trying to lead discussions on this issue, and they've been pretty helpful. But at the last round of meetings, right about the 4th of July, this is when the diplomats kind of blew up at each other, and so we're hitting an impasse. And this is where the U.S., I think, can help in terms of a country that a lot of the states in the region will listen to in terms of moving forward. So I don't think it's necessarily companies paying off Kabila. I think this is more of an issue for diplomats. Now, longer term, certainly there are Kabila has many financial interests that make, you know, his stay a lot longer. And so there needs to be more transparency in the economic dealings in Congo. And part of that solution is, frankly, exposing the companies who were actually investing there. So there's new U.S. legislation on the books or in Congress at the moment, led by Senator Carl Levin, to disclose the beneficial owners of companies. And that, I think, can be very helpful, not just in Congo, but in Africa-wide context by unearthing a lot of the dirty business that's been going on. And so we come to a new, more transparent, fair level playing field for Africans living on the ground.
And of course, it's worth noting that the leader of the opposition in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Jean-Bertrand Iwanga, was just arrested a day after he took part in a rally to oppose extensions of President Kabila's term.
We've seen that happen many times to many different opposition leaders. I've personally met several opposition leaders myself who faced many, many difficulties, can't travel within the country. It's, you know, democracy is not nearly there yet in Congo. And I think that, you know, it's very important for Congo to have a peaceful transition process and for the U.S. to also put strong pressure on Kabila and his government not to run again in the next elections and make sure that those elections are, in fact, held on time.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Sasha Lezhnev.
Thank you so much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Sasha Lezhnev, who is the Associate Director and Senior Policy Analyst at the Enough Project, where he focuses on peace and conflict minerals in the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's the author of the book Crafting Peace, Strategies to Deal with Warlords in Collapsing States, and has an op-ed at the Daily Beast with John Prendergast, Obama's Africa Summit and the New Danger in Congo. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.